This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Place to Be Nation, welcome to PTBN's NBA Team Podcast. I am your co-host, Andrew Reich. Unfortunately, I don't have my other co-host, the Michael to my Scotty, the Shaq to my Kobe, the Ron Swanson to my Leslie Nope, Mr. Adam Murray. He is off in Finland. Now, this time, I know we were doing a little bit of a play on the previous episode that we did, but he really is in Finland, so if you have any questions for him, go ahead and get him on Twitter or send a little dove that way and see if they can get over the Atlantic Ocean or whatever ocean that is. But so I do miss Adam. I really do. And so I think he's so important that I had to get not one but two people to replace him adequately for this special episode that we're going to be talking about. It's not going to be anything current. In fact, it's going to be a bit of a retro version this time again. And this is going to be about the 1990s. And I think I got two 90s fanboys. They're fanboys of a different variety, but I'm going to go ahead and introduce them now. They are two co-hosts on the This Week in Marvel podcast, which you can check out on Marvel.com. One of these people you'll be familiar with, and the other not so much. I'll introduce the familiar one first. And that would be the purveyor of Marvel.com. I keep telling him that's his official name now, Mr. Ben Morse.
Hey, man. This is probably the PTBN podcast you're least likely to find me on, so I'm kind of excited that I somehow made my way here, because usually when you guys are talking sports during the wrestling shows, I just kind of check my Twitter feed and stuff, but you're actually talking about something I love, so I'm very excited about it.
So in comics talk, this is a one-shot.
Yeah.
it's a super team-up. It's like Batman Punisher, only the one that's actually good, not the one.
It's more like Punisher Eminem, and I'd be Eminem because it doesn't make any sense for me to be here, but here I am.
I'm glad you're here to join me to do this. Now I want to introduce the one that people aren't so familiar with, but if you listen to Marvel.com and you listen to This Week in Marvel podcast, and if you don't, you should! And that is a man who I want to introduce. I'm glad to talk to him. He's a big basketball fan, and his name is Blake Garris. Oh, wow, almost did it. Blake Garris, how you doing?
Hey, it's funny you said that, because a lot of our coworkers get Ben and I mixed up all the time, too, so...
Yeah, they usually get our first names mixed up. I've never heard the last name, but
I almost said Blake Morris. I was like, no, Blake Morris. I was like, it sounds like an NXT wrestler. But but no, I'm glad to have both of y'all on here. Now, people will say, okay, why do you have two comic book podcasters to talk about the NBA in the 1990s? Well, they do have a little bit of history there. Maybe not as familiar for some, but I do want to go ahead and get started and get it rolling by asking them one by one about what their recollection is. I'll begin with Ben. Ben, what kind of familiarity or introduction did you have to either NBA basketball or basketball in general when you were a youngster, while you were reading the comic books and just being a kid in general?
Well, I grew up in Boston. So that right there, I grew up in Boston in the 80s. So I was in the midst of kind of like the second Celtics dynasty. But more beyond that, my dad was a huge basketball fan. He was actually a great high school player. And he played down at the Newton YMCA. It was from Newton, Massachusetts. And actually, the Celtics used to come to the gym, and he would practice some of them. He used to practice with Dave Cowens. He practiced with some other guys. My dad, when he was in high school, got hit by a car and broke everything on the left side of his body. So it pretty much ended his basketball aspirations, but he was still always a huge fan. Him and his buddies, just like a group of them, like 10 of them or so, they would, every year they split season tickets for the Celtics. So they'd go to a bar and they'd essentially do a draft, like same as you do like a lottery draft or anything. And they would draft which games each person got to go to, and you get two tickets. So you, and you could bring someone else. So my dad, from when I was a kid, would always bring me to Celtics games. And this is like late 80s, early 90s. So the Celtics were kind of like, they were exiting their little glory period, like their second glory period. Mm-hmm. But I got to see all the great players of the late 80s and early 90s because they'd all come through Boston, of course. So, you know, I'd get to see Magic and eventually Jordan and Barkley and all these other guys. And as the 90s went on, you know, more and more guys. And that lasted up through the mid-90s, but I got super into basketball as a kid. And then besides that, my dad also was a BC alumnus, Boston College, and Boston College was literally 10 minutes down the street from me, so we had season tickets there as well. So I was, you know, partially location and partially just, it was something I could do with my dad. It was something I got really into. I became a huge, like, fan of the history of the Celtics, just because it was such a rich history going back to the 60s. I read a ton of books and stuff like that. Like, I read Red Auerbach's book and I read all those, so I got really into that. The only thing I wasn't into was I tried to, my dad really obviously wanted me to play basketball, and I did, and I was awful at it because I don't have a dominant hand. Like, I'm ambidextrous, which is usually good. Mm-hmm. But when it came to basketball, I can't shoot for shit because I can't, like, get one of my hands to be the dominant one. So I'd always end up, like, shooting, like, two-handed, like a girl. And it never ended well. So eventually I swapped basketball for wrestling when I was in high school, and that worked out a little better. But I throughout the end of the 90s, I was always a fan. I loved the sport.
It's funny. It's interesting that you say that about the shooting, because that's the same way for me. I'm right-handed. Yeah. I always wrote right-handed. But when it comes to shooting the ball, I always shot it ambidextrously. Now, you know, I can shoot it with one hand if I had to. I would practice twisting layups like you see in the highlight reels. But when it came to just a straight shot, yeah, I was the same way. I would use both extensions from my hands, from my fingers to release it. And a lot of people would look at it as kind of funky, but it was just something that I grew up, and that was what I was kind of familiar with too. So it's funny that you say that, because I kind of grew up in the same situation.
When I went over to England for my junior year of college, because I did a semester abroad, because I was American, they wanted me to try out for their basketball team. I was at, like, this small college up in Norwich. It's actually where Paige from WWE is from. She grew up in the same town. Mm-hmm. But they wanted me to try out for the basketball team just because I was American. And English people, like, they were all terrible at basketball. So they're like, come on, come try out for the basketball team. Like, you're American, you must be good. And I still wasn't good, but I was good enough that I made the team. And I played for, like, two games, and then I was just like, oh, this is terrible. Like, I don't want to spend my semester abroad, like, doing practice and stuff. Yeah. But I can always say that I played college basketball.
That does not surprise me, because the host country in the Olympics automatically qualifies. So the UK had a team in the 2012 London Games. But I'm glad to hear the story about your dad being a former player. It's fascinating. I also like the fact that he's a hardcore Celtics fan. So he's kind of like Simmons, only not annoying and overrated.
I think so.
So Blake is actually from the East Coast as well, but a little bit down south, not far down as me. So what's your story, Blake?
It's obviously far less interesting than Ben's is, but really it's just the fact of I'm from South Carolina, and there was no real sports, like, national sports situation going on there at the time. And at some point, I guess the Hornets started, God, I don't know the year, maybe the Hornets were probably the early 80s.
The late 1988, started. They expanded to the Charlotte Coliseum.
Oh, you do know your stuff. This is good. This was, the first major sports team that was even around my area, so I just jumped at the fact. And then when, I know we'll talk about a little more, but Larry Johnson joined the team, or was drafted. That changed everything. He was the man. And when he became grandmama, that was it.
Well, the thing is, though, I mean, I'm not sure about your stomping grounds, but you attended the University of South Carolina. Now, obviously, there is no pro team in South Carolina. So did you gravitate to the teams in Charlotte and such when you were following as an NBA fan, not necessarily a college fan?
I guess to an extent. I mean, I was a bit of a college fan. We had 2 years where we went to the championship and lost. We were number 2 seed.
Coppin
State. Lost to a 13 seed. Yeah.
Yep.
It was a rough time, and we're still not very good. But it was like, and then again, this is a football situation too. The when the Panthers came along, we all gravitated towards that as well. But I think I was a little bit of a Bulls fan too, just because everybody else was.
Well, Mike.
But yeah.
Well, the thing there with the Celtics and the Hornets, which is interesting, is that right around the time that your fandom started and right around the time that Ben as a kid as well, since obviously y'all are pretty close together in age, I would assume, is that, you know, trying to do another comparison with the comic book speak, is that when worlds collide, a crossover, because one of the most famous playoff series was in the 1993 playoffs, the Hornets played the old beaten down Celtics. Unfortunately, that was also a series where Reggie Lewis started having his heart problems that ultimately led to his death. Rest in peace. Fantastic series, one of the most memorable ones. It ended on a buzzer beater by Alonzo Mourning. He hit a 20-foot jump shot. Any memories from either side on that one, just to kind of get started on the 90s talk?
I mean, for me, it was like at that point, I was kind of transitioning, because I was like, by the time I'd really become a fan, by the time it was like the early 90s, like you said, you're right, it was like the broken down Celtics.
Yeah, Kevin so McHale's last season.
Yeah, but it was tough because I had it's a twofold thing in Boston. Like when you're growing up in Boston in the 80s, especially if you're a sports fan in conjunction with your parents, you hear about how terrible the Red Sox have always been. And then you hear about how great the Celtics have always been.
Yeah, because by this point, the Red Sox had not won a World Series in about 80 years or maybe 70 years.
Yeah. So it was always like for me, my family was never a hockey family. So we never really talked about the Bruins, and the Patriots were kind of like a non-factor. So it was really just like basketball and baseball. And it was like kind of like, you know, the talk you get is like, hey, you're going to like your dad's a genius. He's like, listen, son, you're going to be constantly disappointed by the Red Sox. They're going to break your heart. But we've got the greatest basketball team ever. So as soon as I'm old enough to actually care, it's like it's not this young, vibrant team of like awesome players. It's like you said, it's like, you know, Parrish on his last legs, McHale on his last legs, Dennis Johnson gone.
Yeah, Dean Danny Brown, Kevin Campbell. Yeah.
Yeah, and like, you know, and like you said with the Reggie Lewis stuff happening, like that was devastating because that was the one guy with like the promising future. I mean, you know, number one, just personally, like just being a fan of the guy was tough, but also it was like you kind of saw, you were like, oh man, like where are we going as a team? So it's like I finally am old enough to actually be a legit fan. And all of a sudden, it looks like this team is kind of going nowhere. And I always, with the expansion teams, to me, because I was, you know, don't want to say like a student of the game, but because I really got into the history of the old school teams, like the expansion teams were always to me like, they don't really belong in the league. Like kind of a weird thing. Like definitely a thing that I thought as a kid.
They were the first one to get good. You know, the Timberwolves are garbage. The Heat were okay, but not great. And the other one, the fourth Magic team that we had, the Orlando Magic got Shaq, but they weren't good immediately. It took a little bit.
Yeah, but what you're saying about the 93 series, I remember to me that was like the lowest low because I didn't view them as a good team or a bad team. They were an expansion team. So I was like, oh, crap. Like, we lost the playoff series to an expansion team. So I remember that was devastating. That was one of the reasons I stopped. I started not being like solely a Celtics fan. Like I started being like, all right, like this team doesn't seem to be going anywhere. They'll always be like number one in my heart.
I would have been sad in 1993 to tell little Ben it's going to be worse because, you know, they're going to tear down the Boston Garden. They're going to hire Rick Pitino and they're gonna be terrible for 7 or 8
years. It wasn't a good time to be a kid Celtics fan.
No, absolutely not. And Blake, obviously you're on the other side of that coin, at least for this particular series in which they won in 4 games, and Alonzo Mourning came in, and even though they were okay under Larry Johnson, they were still a losing team. But they brought in Alonzo. He was great from the start. They had Del Curry, Hersey Hawkins, Muggsy Bogues. It seemed like things were looking up. What happened?
I guess it wasn't really a factor being a Hornets fan for me, and I don't think for a lot of people, just for the fact that, you know, we had sellouts every game for however many seasons. And I remember going to games, to playoff games, and not even caring if we won or lost. I mean, it was cool if we won, but, I mean, just being in that setting was, like, the best feeling in the world. Like, I remember we had Hugo, and then we had, I forget his name, it was, like, Duncan Hugo or something.
Yeah. Yeah, he was one of the first, like gymnasts to be a mascot.
Yeah, it's like, I can only compare it to, like, the Oregon Ducks. Like, I don't like the Ducks. I don't care about them, but their, you know, jerseys are so awesome. The colors are perfect. And I think that had a lot to do with the Hornets coming back.
Absolutely.
I mean, the purple and teal was just perfect. And I mean, comparing to now, like, I'm sure you know the whole Bobcat fiasco. It was like they couldn't sell out any seats. It was just they did everything wrong they could do, and they had the opportunity to have a really good fan base.
I know the Bobcat situation very well because we stole them. You know, I live in New Orleans, so we're the team that they relocated to originally as the New Orleans Hornets, now renamed the Pelicans. So what he's talking about is that in 2005, they expanded. Robert Johnson, who was the president of Black Entertainment Television, created a team, and he named it after himself, which is never a good start for a team. The Charlotte Bobcats with a gray, like a light blue, and a diarrhea orange, and didn't really work out so well.
It was brown and orange, I think.
It was nasty. It was not. Yeah. I didn't like it. Now, you know.
I just want to say, like, when we heard that they had a team that they were going to start, everybody was really excited. And then we're like, why are they called the Bobcats? Because I don't remember Bobcats being around in North Carolina. And then it's like, oh, he named it after himself. It's like, oh, great. This is going to go poorly. And it obviously did.
They were just happy to get rid of George Shinn. That was really one of the main purposes behind the whole thing. What was fun, though, about those...
Story?
Oh, yeah?
Is that a story we can bring up? Because that's insane.
About the sexual harassment claims?
Yeah.
You can go ahead.
I mean, from what I heard, and you probably know more, but, like, I had heard he sexually harassed somebody on the Hornets, and he had said that he wanted to start a new stadium, but they wanted to push him out. And he moved to New Orleans, and then apparently harassed the girl there too. And now that's why he doesn't seem to be found anywhere anymore.
He claimed he was born again, and so he didn't want to own an NBA team anymore. So he was going to be willing to sell it to whoever the highest bidder was, regardless of whether it was in California or Seattle. And the situation got so dire that David Stern actually had to buy the team off of him just to guarantee that the Hornets would not relocate away from New Orleans and stay there, so that they could find a proper owner to make sure that it wasn't relocated. That's how George Shinn, class act. But
The last I heard about Shinn was his son is now the lead singer of the band Live, I think.
The bald guy in Live?
Yeah, Lightning he left.
Crash is Live.
Yes, he quit and did a solo album, and then George Shinn's son, this is probably 2 years ago at least, he was the lead singer of Live.
That makes my heart so bad. Because Shin's son would sit at courtside, and he would look like such a moron with his freaking frosted tips and his hair gel and his dumb baggy pants and the chain around his belt. I wanted to kick his ass.
Is that like, so that's like Lightning Crashes Live?
Yep.
Post oh my god.
Lightning Crashes.
Dude, well, yeah. You have no idea how much epic disappointment I just like felt when you said that. But
the thing we used to do in North Carolina, my friends and I, every time we go on this lake, it's a really fancy lake where all these rich people live, and George Shinn had it like this giant mansion on the lake, and we would ride a boat past it and just gaze in awe at all the money he had. So this is obviously before all the, all the harassment stuff.
Well, the Hornets, you know, it's interesting because Alonzo, when he got traded to the Miami Heat, got a reputation for being an incredible defensive center, which he was. He was a great shot blocker. He was physical. He had a nasty attitude. But what they forget about the Hornets is that they were an up-tempo scoring team that would just score like the bunches. That's what made him even more enjoyable for the people that would not – I mean, not only just the fact that purple and teal was kind of a hip type of like color scheme, but, you know, wear their starter jackets and there were the champion shoes and the grandmama shoes and the windbreakers, but that was a fun team. There was a variety of fun teams in the NBA. Ben, when the Celtics started kind of going down that path, obviously most NBA fans are sort of ambiguous. They sort of like where the stars gravitate towards. Was there a team that you really enjoyed watching?
I was the opposite of that, actually, sort of in a way, because the thing I liked about Blake knows where I'm going, but like. The thing I liked about the NBA in the 90s and why I got so into it, and like, I guess we'll probably talk about like it compared to today and why it was more appealing then. But what I liked about it was like there was a lot more parity. It felt like there was bad teams, but I look at it this way. like when they came out with NBA Jam, there was enough good players that you could get two people on every team. They didn't have to leave teams out. Right?
Except for the Mavericks, who had Mike Uzunu.
Yeah, but they didn't leave him out of the game. So the thing for me was, like, I like the fact that, you know, almost every team had at least one good player, if not two. And then, you know, the best ones had a good core. And so a lot of people could compete. It wasn't the sense of, like, all right, there's only, like, three or four teams because – they're in the money markets and they have enough money to put together like a big three, which is a big thing now. Like everyone has to have a big three. So I was really into, I wasn't into the Bulls. The Bulls kind of screwed this all up for me because I was like, when they started going on the dynasty run, this is, you know, hypocritical or ironic or whatever, coming from someone who was a Celtics fan. But I hated the fact that they were so good because I liked the idea that anyone could win. Like, I like the idea that, you know, that one year, like, the Blazers could win, and the next year, you know, the Spurs could win or something like that. But I gravitated towards the teams that hadn't won championships and who are, like, kind of, like, would be, like, not a Dallas Mavericks long shot, but, like, would be kind of surprising. So I really liked, first and foremost, I love the Phoenix Suns because I really liked Kevin Johnson. Kevin Johnson was my favorite player.
Yeah.
I liked the fact that he was a smaller guy who didn't have like kind of the recognition that some of the other point guards got. Like,
no,
certainly not like a Magic
Johnson. He was the first of his kind because he was a scoring point guard.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like in the vein of Russell Westbrook. And he was an incredible athlete. Like, anybody who remembers his dunk down the baseline on Hakeem Olajuwon knows that guy could fly.
I had a full size poster of KJ in my room when I was a kid. And it was not like that was not like people liked Kevin Johnson, but he wasn't a, you know, household name. There wasn't a lot of people who liked him. Certainly not a lot of people in like Boston. I really liked the Suns. They were my number one. And also I really liked Barkley. So when he came to the Suns, that was like I liked him separately. Like when he was on the Sixers, I liked him a lot. I just, you know, obviously just loved the attitude. I loved the fact that he had never won. And he was so hungry. So when he came to the Suns and it was like KJ, Barkley, Dan Marley, the other guys who came in and out. I really like the Suns. And I also like, I kind of like the Golden State Warriors.
Run TMC or the Weber Warriors?
No, I like Chris Mullins. He's my guy. I had the same haircut as him. And I got it. And I got it specifically because I said, can you cut my hair like Chris Mullins? And the guy that cut my hair had no idea who Chris Mullins was. And I brought in a picture from like Inside Stuff.
So instead of the Mohawk, it was like the Close Hoff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I like the suit, like the super flat
crew
cut. So those were the teams I started going over to, and obviously neither of them ever won, but I liked them. I had more fun rooting for the Phoenix Suns to potentially do something on the off chance they would than I ever would have rooted for like the Lakers or the Bulls.
I think you're on to something there about the parody in the 1990s, which a lot of people really don't give that era credit for it, because the thing that was the thing that was absolute about the 1990s was that the bottom feeders, outside of maybe one or two that sort of dropped out after some success in the late 80s, is that the bottom feeders, the worst teams, were almost always the same. It was usually the Clippers, the Nuggets, the Mavericks. For a little while, the Golden State Warriors by the end of the 1990s, once Run TMC ran its course. And the middle portion of the Western Conference and the top of the Western Conference were really not, kind of like today, was really not that far apart. So, you know, you mentioned like that the Michael Jordan Chicago Bulls thing sort of masked, and we're going to talk about this in a later topic, is that Michael's Bulls sort of masked some of the perception and kind of twisted it, because it made it seem like, okay, you look at the, you know, the Sports Almanac that Biff stole in Back to the Future Part 2, and you look at Michael Jordan, Michael Jordan, Michael Jordan, Hakeem, Michael Jordan, Michael Jordan, Michael Jordan. So you just think to yourself, okay, so it was just Michael Jordan was dominant and there was no one better. Au contraire, there was a lot of excellent teams that not only had to duke it out against one another in the Western Conference, but also in the East. You know, Michael had to step up in order to get rid of those guys and vanquish them in order to win those titles over and over again. So I think you really do have a great point about that. I want to ask this one to Blake. I'm not sure if you're the biggest Michael fan, but since you're from the Carolinas, I'm sure you closely followed his Chicago Bulls teams. What playoff opponent between Ben mentioned the Suns in 1993. He mentioned also in passing the Blazers in 92. There was the Jazz those 2 years. There was the Sonics. And then there was those Knicks and Pacers teams in the early 90s and late. What team do you think was the toughest opponent for the Bulls? Which one, as if you were a Bulls fan, just made you shake in your shoes?
I mean, I guess kind of touching on what you guys are talking about. Like, I was a big Sonic fan, too. Like, Sean Kemp was really powerful. He kind of reminded me of he had the stature of, you know, Johnson to an extent. I mean, he had those really cool shoes. And then Gary Payton was just amazing. And, you know, and then they had the goofy guys on the team. Like, that's what I loved about back in the day, too. Like, Detlef Schrempf and people like that, you know. Like,
yeah, Hersey Hawkins and Frank Borkowski.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, I guess the Sonics didn't do that great against the Bulls then, did they?
Here's what I'll give the Sonics credit for. That was the year the Bulls went 72-10. It was the greatest team ever in NBA history. They destroyed everyone they played. They played a Magic team that eliminated them the year before when Michael was getting the rust off of them from playing baseball. And they swept them so badly that Shaq ran out of town and signed with the Lakers. They played the Sonics and went up 3-0. But then the Sonics beat them twice in a row, something no one ever did to them. So you got to give at least a little bit of credit to the Sonics, and also Gary Payton, because Payton gave Michael a lot of trouble on the defensive end, because he was one of the best defensive guards, if not the best defensive guard of all time. So the Sonics were, you know, they beat him in 6 games, but it wasn't as close as it seemed.
I remember, was that the year that the Bulls went almost undefeated at home?
Yes.
Actually, that happened twice. Oh, I remember distinctly, I was watching the Hornets again, obviously, play. They were playing the Bulls. The Bulls were undefeated at the time. And it was like Kenny Anderson and Anthony Mason were playing for the Hornets. And it was like, there's no chance in hell that they're going to win. And I think the Hornets were the only team that beat them.
I think that was in 96 when Dave Cowens celebrated and ran through the rampway. Yeah, I remember that one. That was right when they still had Glenn Rice, and right after the Alonzo trade, so they were sort of in a switch of identity. Yeah, those late 90s Bulls were awesome. You know, the Suns were awesome too, because they were in the early 90s when scoring was still on the up and up, and they were the best scoring team in the league. They were a machine. The team that I always thought was their real, like, I mean, a real pain in their ass was that 1998 Pacers team that Larry Bird coached.
Yeah.
That they were tough as nails, incredible veteranship. Everybody had been around the block except for maybe Travis Best, and they were just so tough. They went 7 games with the Bulls. They had them up like about 9 points with about maybe in the fourth quarter or maybe late in the third. And I mean, there was a moment there where I thought, oh my God, the Bulls might actually lose. And I never felt that way in the finals, not even against the Jazz, not against the Suns. The only thing I have to criticize the Pacers for is their brotherhood act of shaving all their heads. Because, you know, it must have broken Ben's heart, because Chris Mullin was on that team.
Yep.
And off went the Mohawk.
He looked so bad. He looked terrible.
Yeah.
Like, some guys just aren't meant to be bald. Chris Mullin as well.
Yeah, Reggie Miller looked fine.
He's fine. He already had basically no.
Fred Hoiberg, not so much.
Yeah,
but
the Hornets did that too. I remember Matt Geiger shaved his head.
Yeah,
and this is all coming back.
Yeah, it's the '90s version of the playoff beard.
Yeah,
you know? It's like
playoff beard's way better though.
Playoff beards are way better.
It's a better idea.
I
want to ask you this though, Andrew. Like, you mentioned some players, it's really great players, but they all seem to have been notoriously like dirty back in the day. Like, Payton was notoriously dirty. Reggie Miller was obviously really dirty. Do you think it's like that's what's lacking in the NBA these days? Kind of the lack of that kind of player.
Well, there's a lack of that, and it's for reasons both institutional and incidental. And I think the main thing that you're talking about is trash talk. Like, Gary Payton was a big time trash talker, so is Reggie Miller. And what happened also is that in the late 90s, the influx of talent wasn't as good coming out of college as it was in the 80s, when all these guys were well prepared. They spent at least, I mean, Jesus, Shaq Shaquille O'Neal spent 3 years at LSU before he went to Orlando. So these guys were ready. They had well-honed skills by the time they became all-stars in the NBA. And I think a few things happened. Number one, we went from 23 teams in the late 80s to 29 teams by the end of the 1990s. So it saturated the talent across the board. So like Ben was saying about the parity, it wasn't as prevalent anymore because you were getting, you know, the more teams, the less talent you have across the board. So the only way in order for a lot of these coaches, in order to keep games close with less talent or less star players, is to muddy up the game, play defense. And Pat Riley was kind of one of those guys, one of the linchpins there, because he was like the leader of Showtime. And then he goes to New York. I always compare this to like when Vince McMahon did the end. I don't know if you're a wrestling fan at all, Blake, but you know, Vince McMahon. He did the NWO thing in 2002. So he was doing this like really evil thing, like, I created it, I'm gonna kill it. And that's kind of like what Pat Riley did. He created Showtime, the most entertaining, up and down, fun offensive game, and he killed it when he went to New York because he put the ball in Patrick Ewing's hands and he muddied up the game. It was like an even dirtier version of what the Bad Boy Pistons did, because at least the Pistons were really talented on the offensive end. The Knicks were not. So,
Go ahead. I was just going to say, this is something Ben and I haven't really spoken about yet, but since obviously we're close to the same age, I am kind of shocked now that I'm older about some of these players and how bad they were and how trash-talky they were, like you're talking about. Yeah. Like, I had no clue that Isaiah Thomas was a trash-talker. The only two I thought were bad were obviously John Starks and Bill Laimbeer.
Yeah, watching that 30 for 30 was like a revelation for me.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, wow, they're all, yeah.
Yeah, in the 80s it was there, but the thing about the 80s, I felt like there was a pinch of respect for between even the Celtics and the Lakers, who hated each other. At least there was this respect of, well, they've got some game, so we need to be on our game. I didn't feel that way in the late 90s as these teams started to have these rivalries, like the Knicks and the Heat and the Knicks and the Pacers. And I'm trying to think of a few other ones, like the Lakers and the Jazz. I didn't feel like there was respect. I felt like it was lost, and I felt like things got nastier and nastier. Yeah. And it got to a point where, and we're not going to talk about the early 2000s, but it got to a point at that time frame where it got so physical, so nasty, everything turned into a rock fight, and then the Artest melee happened, and they went into the spin cycle, and they had to clean up the game. Now you're at a point where if what John Starks and Isaiah Thomas and Larry Bird, if you say even half the shit they said to their freaking opponents, you get a technical and probably get thrown out of the game at the same time. You know, they had to clean up the game.
Was the Sprewell situation a big factor as well with the coach?
I think the Sprewell thing in 1997, where he choked PJ Carlissimo, was more of an issue regarding perception, and that's more of like the macro versus the micro. You know, the thing that happened is that we talk about this new blood. They called them the Jordanaires, guys who were there to kind of replace Michael Jordan when his time was up. And the problem was that a lot of those guys, Allen Iverson, Stephon Marbury, later years, Tracy McGrady and Vince Carter, and Latrell Sprewell was another one of those high volume scorers, big time attitude, wore the cornrows. So the perception of this black man with a lot of braggadociousness choking his white coach and calling him a piece of shit and thinking that he's above authority was a bad look for the league. So I felt like that, in the way, same way as Artest, was more of a reaction to an act and trying to spin it instead of actually trying to fix the problem. I think you got a good point there about Sprewell being one of the reasons why the fans sort of turned on the product. Because Michael's Bulls in the late 90s, the early 90s Bulls didn't mask too many problems with the league as a whole, because that was when the Dream Team was around. And there was a lot of great players, a lot of great talent. You could go to NBA Jam and probably close your eyes and press the A button and you'd find an awesome player that you're going to play. In the late 90s, not so much. And, you know, when the Bulls went away, it was kind of like that curtain was lifted, and all of a sudden, you know, the emperor has no clothes. And that was a big problem for the NBA when we got to the close of the 90s. That's why I think the 90s has a special, special place.
So do you think you'll ever, like, maybe come back to something like that, or is that just kind of there and gone?
I think we're there. I think we're at a point in the – yeah, I really do. I think we're at a point in the NBA where that – cleaning up the game, it sort of instituted new rules of not hand-checking, not getting physical, and some other things that sort of, you know, ease the flow of the game to make offense more of a primary focus for these teams. But the talent influx has been fantastic for the last 7 or 8 years. You know, LeBron is not going anywhere. Kevin Durant's not going anywhere. The superstars are more selfless than they've ever been. I think that was the main problem with the late 90s teams. They were very much about me. You know, I want to get my 50 points. I want to get my, you know, I want to get my name on a shoe. And I don't think that egotistical nature is built into these players as much as it was back then. So I think we're sort of right there where scoring is back and the fun factor in the NBA is back but the problem though, that I have with it, Blake, is that it's not free flowing. It's not fun because the players are fun. It's fun because the NBA tries to make it fun. So it's kind of like when Vince McMahon says, "Hey, you guys have fun out there." And it's like, no, this sucks. You know, this ain't fun. You know, and sometimes you get that feeling sometimes when you watch some of these teams where they're either tanking it or they just don't look like they want to be where they are. You know, but that's just a problem with pro sports in general. Any franchise, you're going to see guys like that.
But what you're saying, like, man, that was a big part of the appeal in the early 90s, because you really break the 90s into two segments, the early 90s and the late 90s. You look at even like the best players, like the Michaels, the Barclays, the Ewings, all those guys, like they are even going like, you know, even further back, looking at Magic and Bird and Isaiah, like they were unselfish. Like they wanted to win, but they wanted to win as a team. And like someone like, you know, look at like a Larry Bird, who is famously difficult to get along with. But when he was out on the court, like he had no problem making everyone
from Robert Parrish. The ultimate team player.
Yeah, no problem making everyone from Robert Parrish to Dennis Johnson look good. And like Barkley, who was so infamously, you know, confrontational and so in your face, or like a Dennis Rodman. Like, but when those guys were on the court, like, you know, they want to make their teammates look good because it made them look good and that made the team look good. The end goal was to win. Like there was that period where it just felt like, you know, some of the guys you mentioned, the later years guys were just about, you know, I want to get out on the court. I want to get my endorsement deal. I want to make as much money as I can. I don't care as much about necessarily winning the ring. At least that's what it felt like.
Yeah, it was like you take the Wii and you flip it and it's me.
Yeah.
You know, and that was a big part of it too. Ben, you mentioned Kevin Johnson. He was he had a poster on your bedroom, and you loved him. You almost would look at him to do another comic tie-in for you and Blake Garris from Marvel.com here joining me on the show. Player as superhero, you know, and we see this, you know, that's why we don't call them stars. We call them superstars. Well, I mean, the real advent to that of that, in my opinion, was the Dream Team, the 1992 Barcelona Olympic team, who was it was the first year in which professional basketball players in the United States were allowed to play in Olympic play, and they did. And David Stern and the USOC pulled out all the stops and put together the most unstoppable team I've ever seen. You know, they made that movie Space Jam where the Monstars come in and they try to take.
Blake loves Space Jam.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you this. If the Monstars landed and they saw the Dream Team, I think they'd go back in their spaceship because the Dream Team was absolutely unstoppable. I want to make a comparison here and just have y'all, you know, kind of play to your interests. And that is that the Dream Team, in a weird way, in the 1992 era, in the early 90s, reminds me a little bit of the Avengers. And
it wasn't a weird way. It was like, for me at that age, I was 10 when the Dream Team came out, and someone who liked comics and who liked wrestling, like this was the ultimate, like, oh, cool, they're doing the thing I want to see. Because when you're doing comics or when you're doing anything, when you're doing any sort of like fiction, the big draw is getting all of the biggest heroes or wrestlers, wrestling good guys, getting them all together and giving them a common purpose. And the Dream Team, as much as it was about, like, you know, winning the gold medal for America and all that, as a marketing tool, like, it was the coolest thing ever. I think it hooked a lot of people who weren't necessarily even sports fans. Even for me, I was like, that was when I was still kind of like entering, and that kind of sealed it for me. Cause I was like, holy crap. Like all the best guys are in the same place and they're all going for the same thing. And they're all like, you know, they're rivals, but now they're together. Like, I remember that classic Sports Illustrated cover where Magic and Larry and Michael were together in
the
USA.
Yeah, Michael's looking up at Magic, yeah.
Yeah, like that was, that like crystallized for me, like, all right. And that's why I thought the NBA was cool, because you had the guys to do that. Like, you had enough talented guys that there were people who weren't on the team who probably should have been.
Right place, right time.
Yeah, but it was like, there were like Isaiah Thomas. I know there was reasons Isaiah Thomas wasn't on the team, supposedly. Mm-hmm. But just the idea that they could field a full squad and have not have Isaiah and not have some of the other, you know, really talented guys, that was how good the NBA was then.
Yeah, but and, I think you hit the point there when you said one of those phrases, common purpose. Like, yeah. You know, Chuck Daly was the head coach. He infamously never called a timeout in any of the Olympic Games. And that's because they were so dialed in to win the gold medal. The only shame of it, and the difference between the Dream Team of the early 90s and the Avengers and their fantastic movie, you talk about marketing and the fact that the Avengers was the biggest box office smash in the history of anything outside of, I believe, maybe Avatar. I'm not sure anything else that's been.
No, it's number three.
Yeah, number three.
Like,
yeah.
Avatar and Titanic.
Avatar and Titanic. Yep. James Cameron's everything.
The only one holding us down.
Oh, he holds everyone down. But I'll say this for the comparison is that, you know, the Dream Team didn't have a low key. They didn't have an Ultron. They didn't have a team that – they didn't have a team or a megastar that they had to go against in order to thwart them.
Well, there wasn't a big rival. Their enemy was just the fact that we – that it was the fact that the 88 team sucked. Like that was the enemy we were trying to beat.
All college kids.
Yeah, we were just trying to. We weren't trying to beat any one particular team, because I think we knew from the start like no one was going to beat the Dream Team. It was just beating the idea that America wasn't the best at something.
Yes. Do you also think, in a small way and in kind of an inverse way, I'll throw this to Blake. Do you think, in it's kind of like, I don't want to say the Avengers' success was bad for Marvel, because nothing like that is ever bad for you when you're making billions of dollars on one of your licensed properties. But the fact that you go to such a high that you kind of find yourself catching a ghost. Do you feel like the Dream Team, their mega popularity and their blooming greatness was something that kind of haunted the NBA in the later years when things didn't go so well?
That kind of makes sense. I mean, I was like Ben as well. I was sort of into this first Dream Team, but that second team was the one that really got me, with like Penny Hardaway, Jack, Grant Hill. Yeah. But they still didn't, I mean, they obviously killed everybody, but they didn't have the success that the original Dream Team had, I don't believe, like, I guess outside of the game. So yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
It didn't, the Dream Team 2, and also there was a team that played in the U.S. World Championships in 94 in Toronto that had like Mark Price and Joe Dumars and Shaq and guys like that. They didn't capture the imagination of the pop culture sphere the way that the Dream Team did. It's, you know, I hate to compare it to Guardians of the Galaxy, but Guardians of the Galaxy are like the guys that weren't supposed to be successful and somehow did it. You know, this isn't the same thing. You know, like, these guys were supposed to be successful, and not only were, but did it in spades. You know, and so they were so dominant in their trade that it kind of made everyone else look bad. You know, do you see, is that comparison kind of apt with the Avengers? Like, it just makes everything else look bad because it's hard to top it.
Yeah, I mean, I guess a lot of us, obviously, like you kind of mentioned, had low expectations for Guardians, but like, it did so much better than we even thought it would do. Mm-hmm. So it's like, I don't know. It seems like people, if they expect, I think people are aware that nothing is probably going to be the Avengers again. And it seems like people are cool with it. I don't know, Ben, do you think that's kind of the case?
I mean, yeah, what I think, you know, Blake's saying, I think is right, is that you can only do that once. You can only bring, it's the same way the original Dream Team, you can only bring all the biggest stars together once for the first time, because then you got to find other creative ways to do it. I mean, that's what we're trying to do, is like, you know, we got a sequel coming out with Age of Ultron, and it's like, we don't have that novelty anymore. We don't have the novelty of, you've never seen stars this big together again before. And that was the same thing with the Dream Team. It's like, you've never seen a team like this. So when you look at, you know, whether it's a sequel or a Dream Team 2, it's like, okay, you have seen stars of this caliber together again. But what's going to be interesting is now, in the case of the movies, there's a new challenge for them. Or in the case of the, well, I mean, I guess that's the difference is for us, we can, because it's fiction, we can find ways to still make it interesting. So we can say, like, even though it's not, you know, Hulk and Captain America and Iron Man coming together again for the first time, what's going to be interesting is the fact that the villain they're facing is different than the first villain they faced. With Guardians, even though this isn't the most well-known characters coming together, it's a different angle. It's space. It's something like that. With the Dream Team 2, you couldn't really do that. You couldn't be like, all right, well, we know you guys have already seen this before. But because it is, you know, it's unscripted, it's real. Like, they didn't have some awesome Russian team that was going to make it more interesting. Because if
it's hard to just build a monster out of thin air.
Yeah, it's like if there was if there was this Soviet powerhouse or like some other foreign menace that Dream Team 2, like, hey, they're not as exciting and they're not as innovative as having the original guys. But if they can beat this unstoppable Russian team, well, that's still kind of a cool, compelling story. Instead, you just had, well, you already saw this, and they're still better than everyone else, but watch it anyways, you know? So it was kind of like there was no twist you could put on. It was just the best guys 4 years later, and some, I would say, like, character-wise and stuff like that, they just weren't as interesting as the original Dream Team.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point to be made there. And like you said, like, you know, your perceptions evolve as you go forward and forward and forward. Like, you go to Dream Team 2, oh, well, they dominated, they won the gold. Well, we kind of thought so, but it was fun. Then in 2000, they almost lose to Lithuania. And you're like, okay, you won the gold medal, but what's wrong with you? And then you get to 2004 and you lose. And you're like, okay, our game is broken. We need to fix it. And that's where the Redeem Team came in 2008. So, you know, I think you make a really good point there about that. I'll just go ahead and kind of throw a few names out there, see if they kind of like ring a bell or if they kind of, you know, they kind of like ring something for you. Between the guys in Run TMC, who would you have to pick? Tim, Mitch, or Chris?
You know my answer. So Shaz Blake, because you already know Mullins was my boy.
So Chris, what about you, Blake?
Ooh. It's gotta be Tim.
Was it the killer crossover?
That helped. Yeah, I just never. I unfortunately did not like Chris Mullins' haircut, and I think that's the reason I didn't like him.
Because Blake's got way better hair than I do.
I think he was a little He was just one-dimensional to me. Tim had a little more flavor. And didn't Mitch, he went to the Bucks?
Mitch went to the Kings. He was traded for Billy Owens.
See, I remember him more from the Kings. Mm-hmm. But he was like the star guy for that really horrible franchise. So I'm going to stick with Tim, but I also respected what Mitch did for the Kings, because he never really gave up, and just like a dismal time for him, you know.
I will say the killer crossover was one of the few things I could actually do, so I did like for that.
You could do the killer crossover.
Yeah, well, like I couldn't, you know, again, I was limited as a basketball player, so I couldn't do like anything that involved shooting or like anything cool. So I couldn't do like a signature shot or anything. But I worked, like, watched Tim Hardaway long enough that I could kind of do at least a facsimile of the killer crossover. Like, not in a game.
Yeah. But, like, not a game.
No, never. Definitely never in a game. But, like, you know, in my driveway, I could do it.
You probably saw the killer crossover from Tim Hardaway along with a lot of highlights from one of our favorite shows in the 1990s. It is so quintessential with the 90s when you even think about it. And that was NBC's NBA Inside Stuff with Ahmad Rashad. What kind of memories? First of all, I want to ask you this. What came first in your fandom? Was it Inside Stuff on the TNBC block or was it Saved by the Bell?
But you want to go first?
No, you were starting it, so go for it.
All right. So I didn't watch Saved by the Bell on Saturday. I never watched Saved by the Bell on Saturday mornings. I always watched Saved by the Bell in syndication because it was like immediately the next season it would be on weekdays in syndication. So I was like, screw that. I can watch it 5 days a week. I'm not going to spend Saturday morning time. So Inside Stuff was much more of a Saturday morning staple for me. And it was always like the cherry on top of the sundae after you watched all the cartoons, because like I'd watch Spider-Man.
Yeah, because it would happen at like 11 or 11:30.
Yeah, it was the signal that your Saturday morning was over, but it was like, all right, we're going to end it with this big, awesome finale. So it was like the big conclusion. It was the big finish. I remember X-Men was on right before it. And then, so I would switch over from Fox to NBC to watch Inside Stuff. Who was the, who's the name of the female host?
There was a few. The first one was actually Julie Moran, who you might remember from Entertainment Tonight with Bob Goen when they would co-host together. But the main one was Willow Bay.
Yep, Willow Bay. I thought.
Oh,
was,
yeah. I had such a crush on Willow Bay.
Huge crush on Willow Bay.
You know, Blake, you know why I knew you would pick Willow Bay? Because her husband is Bob Iger, the CEO of Disney
Company. Yeah, I'm aware.
Yeah. Oh, shoot.
No Willow Bay jokes allowed.
No.
Yeah.
She's a beautiful woman, and Bob Iger's a lucky man.
Okay, but I have to – we had three co-hosts.
I didn't know that.
We had three co-hosts for Inside Stuff. Julie Moran, underrated. Willow Bay – and Summer Sanders.
I don't
Summer Sanders. Oh,
Summer Sanders was an ex-swimming medalist.
Yep. She hosted Figure It Out on Nickelodeon after that night.
Yeah, Nick Gass. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Summer Sanders. And then, you know, obviously Ahmad Rashad, former football player. He was
Ahmad Rashad was the man.
He was the man. He was also Michael Jordan's best friend. He was like, I'm trying to think of it. He was like the Jimmy Hart to Jordan's Hogan. That's the best way I could put it.
Let me ask you this.
You know that story about how, you know, Charles Barkley, they don't think that he was actually friends with Michael Jordan. Michael Jordan was just using him. I start to think, did Jordan actually have any friends for sure? Or do you think he was using Ahmad to, like, bring up his legend?
I think Jordan had a lot of friends in his mind. I felt like, you know, I feel like when you become a star that big, anything that even becomes, like, merely a friendship, you pay closer attention to, because you feel like those people are on your level and you're closer with them, because, you know, it's like being Alexander the Great. How can you be friends with, you know, a pauper if you're the most, you know, powerful man in the world, you know? So he had to be, you know, friends with other powerful people like Tiger Woods and Patrick Ewing. Did he use them in some of these card games where he would try to get secrets out of those teams like Jeff Van Gundy accused him of? I don't really think so. Also, Charles Barkley also claimed that God told him that they were going to win the NBA championship, and that did not happen. So, you know, Charles Barkley is the same one who said he was misquoted in his own autobiography. So,
I believe him.
Chuck's an institution. I love that guy. But no, Michael's got friends. I think Michael is true friends with Patrick Ewing. I think Charles Oakley has always been one of his best friends. You know, I think you make a good point. Did he use that as a competitive edge? Maybe so, but it's hard to distinguish between when it was malicious and when he was just being nice, you know.
Right.
But I think you make a good point there. I'm gonna go ahead and just kind of get into a rapid fire mode with these two as we kind of get to the near end of this. Contrary to popular belief on the Place to Be Nation's main event, I do listen to Ben Morse. In fact, everybody should listen to Ben Morse, not only on Place to Be Nation's main event, but on This Week in Marvel, along with Blake. They have all these types of great interviews, and they like to do some of these rapid fire questions to a lot of their guests. They had Larry Johnson on. That kind of like inspired me to even talk to him in the first place.
That was all Blake. Blake was the one who put that together, and he
sounded like Chris Farley on the Chris Farley Show. It's like, you remember that thing when you dunked it at the grandma? That was awesome.
No, it was funny because I was like, I was kind of worried. Like, I was like, this is a good idea because Larry Johnson does talent relations, but it was really a personal invite as well. That I asked Ben about it, and Ben's just like, yeah, you have to do this. This would be awesome. So Michael,
I do love, you know, listening to that episode, all those episodes. The one I was infinitely jealous of is when they talked to Ryan Adams, who is married to Mandy Moore, one of the greatest women in the history of civilization.
I didn't do that one. Blake did that one. He was talking about it for weeks, and I had no idea who Ryan had. Because he'll every time he has someone in, he's like, "Do you think this is a good idea?" And I'll be like,
"You probably thought it was Brian Adams."
I did initially, but like, yeah, he'll like run by me. He's like, "Do you think this is a good idea? Will people care?" I was, and there was like a time where I was like, "Oh man, I don't know if people would care about it." But he like, I give Blake credit. He like changed my way of thinking of it. Doesn't matter if this person is a comics fan or if it doesn't matter. Like, it's just we have this podcast. We have a fan base. Exposing them to like all these cool personalities, whether they know who they are or not, is cool. And that's what we do. And that's what I love about Blake, is he'll just bring in like the most random people. Sometimes it'll be Larry Johnson. I'll get really excited. Sometimes it'll be Ryan Adams and I have no idea who he is, but I like that we have that variety of people on our show. And you know, like, Blake knows for years, I was kind of like, why are we doing this? Why are we having these people in? And I came around and I think it's a great thing.
But I'm going to go ahead. Go ahead.
Like, I mean, Ben, obviously, and Ryan, who kind of runs the ship, everybody's pretty cool about, you know, hey, let's do this. Let's, like, go out and find these people and stuff. And, you know, our competitors don't really do stuff like that. And it's like, well, you guys are waiting. Like, you got a big character there that a lot of fans know about. Why don't you get some of the stars to talk about them? And nobody's doing it, so. Kind of a shame.
But we're going to go ahead and get into some little bit of a rapid fire so that we can get to the kind of wrap-up point here for Mr. Ben and Mr. Blake. I'll go ahead and start with the first question here. Your favorite 1990s NBA rivalry? You can only pick one.
1990s NBA rivalry. I like the Pacers against the Knicks just because it was so vicious. Like, I think, like you said, by the time we got to the 90s, whether because teams were too good or whether because they were more polite, like you didn't have anything on the level of like the Pistons and everybody in the 80s. And you didn't have two teams that were good enough to be the Lakers and the Celtics. Maybe the closest like Lakers Bulls kind of enjoyed, but I liked Knicks Pacers just because there was a genuine, like you said, there was a genuine dislike there. And sometimes it went a little overboard, but for the most part, I thought it made for compelling games.
And Blake, yourself?
I'm going to go with I'm just going to go with the top of my head thing. I think the Suns against anybody were my favorite rivalry, because especially whenever they played the playoffs, I always was rooting for the Suns because I thought they were the team that deserved to win one championship, and they just never did it.
Okay.
I'm trying to think of a specific Suns rivalry.
The Rockets and them had some epic series in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
I felt like that was their real bugaboo. You know, Barkley will say that to you. I'll play what-if game with both of y'all. Say Michael Jordan doesn't retire, and in 1994 or 95, the Bulls play the Rockets. Who wins?
Well, I think it would have been the Bulls still.
Like, even though their supporting cast was getting a little older by that point before they changed over.
Just because I think that break the Bulls took, I think it has less to do with, I mean, yeah, you needed to refresh the players. You needed to bring in the younger guys to support Michael. But what you talked about earlier in the show with him having to shake off the rust, I think that had a lot more to do with why they dropped off. Like, there's no, like, as much as it was a team game in the 90s, and that was one of the reasons I liked it, there was no one before he left for baseball. There was no one on the level of Michael. As long as he had, you know, at least one or two other guys to back him up, I don't think him at his peak would have been stopped. Just the fact that he came back afterwards and did it again, to me, says that if he had stuck around, I don't think they would have missed a beat.
Yeah, the Emperor retaking his throne. Blake?
So you're saying Jordan never left?
Say Jordan he never retires. So they get to the finals again in 94, and they have to play the Rockets.
Yeah, still total Bulls. Jordan was just too good.
Biggest missed opportunity, and now I might have to explain a little bit in the beginning, but I'll try to follow me here. The Dallas Mavericks when they had Jason Kidd, Jamal Mashburn, and Jimmy Jackson. Or the Bullets when they had Chris Webber, Juwan Howard, and Rod Strickland?
Bullets for me, just because I thought those pieces were better. like as a whole. The Mavericks, some of those guys you mentioned on the Mavericks, I think were better like standout players. But I thought the Bullets, if they could have brought those together, they had a better shot. I just thought they were a more complete package.
You know what the urban legend is about what broke up the Mavericks back then? Tony Braxton. Because supposedly, Jimmy Jackson was supposed to meet up with it was either Jason Kidd or Jimmy Jackson. One of the two was supposed to meet up with Tony Braxton, and the other one hooked up with them that night instead. And there was like a divide in the locker room between the two. They never got along, and basically it was trade me or trade him. And they wound up both getting traded at the end of the day. But I don't know if that's true or not. Tony Braxton denies it to this day, which tells me it's true. But Blake, what about you? I know you got a good Chris Webber story.
Yeah, I'm gonna go with the Mavericks just because Mashburn was another one of those players I felt had kind of a well-rounded-ish kind of game. Chris Webber always just had this black cloud over him since obviously after his college years. It was just a shame, but I never saw Chris Webber ever like doing anything. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the Mavericks.
And what was that happened with Webber?
Oh, okay. I'll try to make it super quick. But my dad he was in Kuwait in the military, and somehow he met the ambassador of Kuwait who invited him to the embassy in Washington, D.C. So I was in eighth grade, and we took a train to D.C. from South Carolina. And if anybody's ever taken a train, it's the most boring thing in the world, free Wi-Fi, free whatever. Anyways, the only thing I had was the sports page, and I was reading it over and over, hour and hour on end. And I get to we go to the hotel, I change, put on a suit, go to the embassy. I'm walking around with my parents, and I see this huge guy, and it's Chris Webber. And I lose it, and I go up to him, and I just start talking to him. And at one point, he's really nice, and I just start naming all the how many points and assists and fouls and every stat that he had the game before. And then I start naming every other player's stats on that game. And at the time I thought I was impressing him, but now I think he assumed I was just this like autistic genius that threw all the stats.
Like a Rain Man.
Yeah. But he was very nice. He took a picture with me, and he said, what was the guy's name who played? He was a small forward at the time on the team.
For what team? The Bullets or for the Kings?
Yeah, for the Bullets.
For the Bullets, there was Juwan Howard, and there was Calbert Cheney.
Uh-huh. Yeah, he was at the party. He was like, I was like, Juwan Howard had 12 points and 14 assists and 6 rebounds and 4 fouls. And he was like, to try to get me away, he was like, yeah, Juwan's supposed to be here, so I'll see you later. And then he said I should come out to a game. And so my dad, like, bought tickets for the next game the day after. And I was, like, trying to wave to him to see if I'd get his attention because I thought we were, like, best friends. And it didn't really work out that way. But
well, you need to hit him up on Twitter and see if he remembers that. But
okay. Is he on might. Twitter?
I don't know. You know, I mean, I know a lot of those because he's on NBA TV and TNT now. So I'd be surprised.
Oh, yeah.
I'd be surprised if he wasn't. But the one about the dark cloud, I think you got a little bit of a point there with the timeout and the fact that the Kings kind of fell short against the Lakers, and it just seemed like it was never meant to be for him. Whereas Mashburn, I think he was just kind of blessed to have a good season, a good career, which he did have. I'll go ahead and ask this one, and this one we can kind of generalize for the 1990s, so you can open up the playbook here. It doesn't have to be basketball, it doesn't have to be comic books or anything in that nature. What? Give me one thing you miss the most about the 1990s.
What I miss about the 90s was, and I guess this is for more entertainment than sports necessarily, but for some reason it kind of translated over into sports, was that the idea of the unexpected, like you didn't know, and this is a byproduct of the internet and all that, and, you know, it's a comics thing, it's a movie thing, it's a TV thing, like, we know everything that's going to happen before it happens now, and all marketing has to be done with the idea that people are going to know things a month in advance. So, you know, if you put out a trailer or if you put out a synopsis, like, you reveal so many secrets by the time you get to the actual show that you're really only watching for a couple of things. For some real weird reason, I feel like that translated into sports, too. I feel like things were, like, more unexpected in the 90s. And maybe, again, it's just the fact that we didn't know as much about everyone. Like these days, like with Twitter and everything else, and you know, I'm sounding like the oldest man ever here, but like, you know, we know all the players so intimately and we have so much technology to track everything that before a game happens, like it has to be a really close matchup before we get really interested. Back in the 90s, and this goes back to parity, the NBA like to kind of come full circle. It's like, it felt like anything could happen. It felt like anyone could beat anybody. And so I guess that was just a thing that the 90s had for me that, like, for some reason, even though it was in the 80s, I wasn't cognizant in the 80s. And by the time we got to the 2000s, it was gone. But just not knowing what was going to happen, something I miss about the 90s.
Blake, what about yourself?
Yeah, it kind of touches on Ben's point, too. It's like, you know, when we were kids, I didn't care or know about the love lives of the players. And, like, if I had known that Michael Jordan was this, like, womanizer guy, jerk, it would have crushed me. Even if I wasn't really a fan of his, but still, it just would have killed me. And when I found out Alonzo Mourning wasn't the nicest guy in the world, that would have just, I would have cried, you know. But I think my big thing was the fashion. I really missed, I wish fanny packs were still cool because they were very helpful and useful.
You miss short shorts?
Yes, those two. I would wear short shorts, fanny pack, and turtleneck.
But this is now. This is key. Were you a Black Sox guy or a White Sox guy?
Ooh,
that was a big thing in the mid '90s. They went to the Black Sox in the late '90s.
I can't take one. You don't know how you're feeling that day.
So if you're feeling moody, you wear the Black Sox? Is that how it is?
Yeah. I lean towards the White Sox, but you got to have a pair of Black Sox just to be safe.
Ben, what about you there?
I always wore White Sox when I was younger in the 90s, and now I only wear Black Sox.
So you're a heel now because heels only wear Black Sox.
No, I thought it was a grown-up thing. Like, Blake will tell you because I wear Black Sox every day to work, but the only time I wear White Sox or any other kind of socks is on the weekends when I'm at home. It was more of like, I was wearing sneakers because Blake and I work at a place where you don't really have to get dressed up, even though a lot of people do. Like, for example, he and I wore the exact same He-Man shirt to work the other day by accident because we got them together at New York Comic Con. And every time I see it in my drawer, I always say, like, I shouldn't wear that at work because Blake might wear it. And then the one day and he feels the same way. And the one day we wore it, like, of course we both wore it.
The best part, it took us 40 minutes to get the shirt, but we had to have it.
Yeah.
We had to go through, like, 7-step process to get a free t-shirt, but we just had to own it.
This has nothing to do with anything we're talking about, but, like, the comic company went by this booth where they were giving out He-Man stuff, and you had to, if I remember it's right, you had to, like, take a picture wearing this thing they gave you, then you had to... A hat. And then you had to put the picture on Facebook, and then you had to like their page. Like, he's not joking, but you had to do, like, 7 different things. We were working, but we were just like, screw it, like, let's get back to work that bad. Like, we really wanted these shirts. So, we got them. But, yeah, my original point was, like, we can kind of wear whatever we want at work, but I don't know. I got it drilled into me at some point, like, that I was like, if I'm wearing dress shoes, I have to wear black socks. And if I'm wearing sneakers, I have to wear white socks. Got very regimented.
Comic book guys on NBA team podcast talking about He-Man. Yeah, we're touching all bases here.
Really? I don't even like He-Man that much. Just a cool shirt.
I'll cheat like I always do. And I'll give you a non-NBA one and an NBA one. The general one I miss. I mean, we see these online anywhere you go, but I miss the brick and mortar, like, specialty stores. Like, I miss the music store, the movie rental store, the antique store. It's gone now. You know, you talk about comic books, and in the 90s, there was a special kind of glow to the comic book store because there really weren't many. And, you know, there was almost that special feeling, okay, it's Wednesday, I'm going to the comic book store. And now you didn't have that feeling when you drove up to the front of the store, like it'd be replaced by a Subway or a FYE, you know, you always had that, like, sense that if something that you loved was going to be there the next day, it was always going to be there. And that's gone now. because of the online, you know, translation of all the sales and the fact that, you know, you can get anything anywhere you want on demand. And,
right.
You know, I miss the music store. I remember Blockbuster Music, and I used to live in that place. There was Tower Records. I used to live in that place, you know, and I miss those places. The other one, and this is NBA, I miss Round Ball Rock, which was John Tesh's piano rock song for the NBA on NBC.
Yeah.
That was like my, you talk about like your, you know, the, when at the end, that inside stuff was kind of like your, like, your dislodging of, okay, it's the end of Saturday morning. I mean, NBA on NBC, when that theme would kick on, I would like go into mode. I'm like, okay, it's play, it's game time. And man, they did the 2012 Olympics on NBC, and they didn't use the music. And I said,
"Oh, like an updated version."
I know it's a shame. Okay, give me a 90s, something from the 90s that you don't miss. And no, you cannot use Chromium comic book covers because nobody misses that. I'll go with Blake first.
I'm gonna say, and again, this is I'm sure I can think of something better, but Pogs.
Yeah.
I would always collect Pogs just to be one with my peers.
Well, how did it work? You had to flip it?
You flip it and something. Here's the catch. I never played because I didn't want anybody to win my Pogs.
Yeah.
So I just collected them.
I did the same thing. Like there was a game you could play, but the game was stupid. Like, it was just you want to collect it.
And I thought they were stupid too, but I was just collecting everything that had to do with it. Was like sports. I think I had Mortal Kombat Pogs and all these other ones that I just had to get. So, Pogs, yeah.
Wow, Mortal Kombat Pogs. I didn't know that one. Ben Morris.
This is hard, man, because I was honestly like running through, and I was like, "There's like nothing about the '90s that I don't miss. '90s were so awesome." I guess if I had to press, like, given like what we do, I guess the one thing. The one thing I don't miss is someone who works in comics and who's interested in kind of like weird stuff like wrestling. I don't miss the idea that, you know, like fringe interests like that were really like kind of taboo in the 90s. Like if you're into that sort of stuff, like you're definitely an outcast. I wouldn't care as much today, but like I do kind of like the fact that post 2000, you know, with the success of comic book movies and wrestling having the hot era and the attitude era, that the stuff I liked started to become cool. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I don't miss that. I don't miss the things I'm interested in being uncool.
Yeah, the nerds winning at the end, but it took a decade to get there.
Yeah, 90s was not a good time to be a nerd. Like, it was hard.
I'll cheat again. Non-NBA, I do not miss dial-up internet.
Oh, yeah.
Just staring, hearing... Oh, my God, I could not... America Online was like my... That was my thing. I think if I could have had stock in AOL, I probably would have done it, and I probably could have bought WCW with it, because that's how much I was on America Online. But the dial-up internet was so bad. I remember if you wanted to watch a movie trailer, you had to get the original QuickTime, and you would literally have to download this bad boy for 30 minutes. And even if it was the worst trailer ever, I had to sit there and stare at it. This was like even before Napster. Like if you wanted to watch a music video, you need to just like watch pictures and then sound come out of it maybe 5 minutes later.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because all this stuff we were talking about hating, like, you know, the fact that the internet spoils everything, or the fact that, you know, like brick and mortar are out of business, at the same time, it's like I like having everything available to me. So as much as I complain about it, I'm like kind of like, yeah, but it's still kind of awesome.
And the NBA version, and it's kind of bittersweet, because rivalries were so prevalent, like we talked about in the 90s, and in today's NBA they're kind of missing, and it's one of the things that we really want back. But I don't miss fights. Like, fights in the NBA were so ugly and so nasty. It wasn't even the kind of like sweet nature type of Kevin McHale throwing Kurt Rambis type of stuff, where it was like perfectly innocent, you know, let boys be boys. There was something, just like I said, there's just something mean-spirited about when like the Heat and the Knicks would get in a scrum with Larry Johnson and Alonzo and Jeff Van Gundy, you know, dangling on his leg like Rocket Raccoon. And it's like this is not basketball. Like, I can't remember how many times I would sit sit there, watch this, and say, this is not basketball. And even though people want rivalries, they want animosity, they want people despising each other. You know, Ben and I do a podcast where we talk about professional wrestling, where 90% of the time, all they talk about is how much people hate each other. But man, it got so bad in the 90s in the NBA that I was so glad that they did away with fights. That's the one thing I don't miss at all. I'll go ahead and ask this one. This is in your wheelhouse. Which Marvel superhero would have been the most successful at playing basketball?
I mean, the kind of dumb answer people would say is Stiltman, because he's super tall. But I feel like he would be easy to take out. So I'm going to say that's Spider-Man, probably. Because Spider-Man, leave it this way, he's quick, he's agile, so he can get around people and he can do crazy dunks, but he's also got spider sense, so he knows like which way someone's going to go. I know like someone who would be listening to our podcast would probably want me to pick someone really obscure, like one of those like Z-list characters that only I know, but because we're on an NBA podcast, I'll go super obvious and say Spider-Man.
Blake?
I would think Hawkeye would be more obvious, and that's my pick.
The marksmanship?
Is that too obvious? Yeah.
No, that ain't mine.
He'd be a good outside shooter. He'd be the ultimate outside shooter.
Yeah.
Do like half court shots, but they'd be like jump up, like layups.
So Hawkeye has marksmanship to which he can do anything with dead point accuracy? Kind of like Bullseye?
I think so.
Yeah.
Bullseye probably be better.
I just picture like I can see Nick Fury being like an old school basketball player, like
the YMCA Oscar guy that's sweating bullets. I don't know how good he'd be on the court because physically his body is bound to a wheelchair, but I would never want to play a team coached by Charles Xavier because he could literally control all the minds of his players and they would never make a mistake.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it'd be like Greg Popovich with the Spurs. Like, how do you beat a team that knows exactly what it's going to do all the time? Like, it's impossible. You could have the best team ever, but you can't beat a team that always makes the right play. Yeah. So that was the only one I was kind of thinking that would have kind of given you a little bit of a laugh. I'm glad I did. And we'll finish out with this one. The both of you always throw out there to your guests on this Week in Marvel on the podcast, if you had a superpower, what superpower would you want? So I wanted to kind of throw it back at you, but change it up a bit. If you could have one basketball trait or a skill, being tall, long arms, great dribbler, great shooter, great dunker, which one, but you can only have one of them, but you'd have it for the rest of your life. Which one would you want?
Probably want to be a very physical rebounder because I feel like there's always a use for those guys. The shooters, the point scorers, the playmakers, those come and go, but I wouldn't mind being like the utility guy who's just like really good on the boards. And I feel like then after my career's over, I'd still be jacked, which I've never been in my life. So I would like to have that. I'd like to just be able to crash the boards and just like grab rebounds like crazy.
So you want to be Kevin Willis?
Sure.
Yeah. Everybody wants to be Kevin Willis. Blake.
I mean, when I was really into the game, I was playing like 6 to 8 hours a day. Like I was crazy. I could dribble, shoot, play defense pretty well. I could not jump. So dunking would have been cool. I remember my friends and I would bring the goal down to like 8 feet so we could dunk, but it still didn't feel the same. So, yeah, dunking, that would be it.
I would have loved to be a great shooter, you know, because it's one of those things where, you know, you hear all these stories about players who practice 20,000 shots a day in the gym, and you watch the NBA games, and they're still not great shooters. So, you know, practice doesn't always make perfect, and for some people, it just comes very naturally. And that's one thing that, you know, that's why one of my favorite players was Reggie Miller. I would go to my backyard, and I would pretend to do the play where he shoots a three, seals the ball, and then shoots another three within 3 seconds. Because I just thought, how impossible is it that this guy just hits a dead accurate three with the guy right on him? He steals the ball, goes back to the three-point line, and then hits another one almost in the exact same way. And it just always fascinates me watching these great shooters from back in the day, like Mark Price and Hersey Hawkins and I remember another really great one was Steve Kerr. And I just always thought to myself, man, I wish I had that talent, because first of all, I would never have to go into the paint and ever get hurt, because all I have to do is sit outside I could go from 30 or 35 feet and swish. And, you know, there's this, I don't know if y'all feel the same way. You know, Michael Jordan did all these fantastic dunks. He did all these like incredible moments. But I think the defining moment of the 90s for everybody was his last shot with the Bulls, when he shot it over Byron Russell after he did the push off. Do you think there's this sort of kind of serenity or like kind of like obnoxious type of peace when you make a mid-range jump shot right in somebody's face?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's as exciting as dunks are on highlight films. Nothing like screams to you like, this guy is incredible, as much as just a beautiful like arc of a shot and taking one from outside, especially if someone's up in your face.
Yeah, and like you always see with Michael at the end, for all the kids watching, make sure you get the follow through. That's the flick is the one that puts it in. Always forget, it's what you do after you shoot it that puts it in. But I wanted to thank both of you, Ben Morris. Thank you for coming on. And Blake Garris, thank you so much also to you as well.
This is a pleasure, sir. Ben and I talk NBA all the time, so it's good to have other people talk with us every once in a while. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Well, this is a lot of fun. I was not sure if we'll be able to keep up, but I think we did an okay job, and Andrew, you did a great job leading us through, man. I'm excited that Blake made his podcast debut, too.
Yeah, I'm just slaving it, trying to get through until Adam Murray gets back over in stateside, trying to find. I think he's still looking for Sheamus. I'm not sure. maybe he is. But on behalf of Ben Morris and Blake Garris from this Week in Marvel, this is Andrew Reich. I'll catch y'all on the bounce, guys. I'll see you next week.